From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty with the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, August 8th, 2019.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by the Dempsey Challenge. Run, walk, or bike this September to help the Dempsey Center support those impacted by cancer. DempseyChallenge.org.
Maine Public Advocate Barry Hobbins says he wants the Public Utilities Commission to take a close look at the proposal by Canadian company ENMAX to buy AmeriMaine, the state's second largest utility. Hobbins says he wants the state to avoid the mistake it made a decade ago in allowing Fairpoint Communications to buy Verizon's landline service in northern New England. In less than 2 years, that company filed for bankruptcy. And as Hobbins continues to say, Central Maine Power has failed to acknowledge problems with the billing system brought online in 2017. A spokeswoman for the company, Catherine Hartnett, continues to say there are few problems with the system.
The Liberty audit that was released last December confirmed that our meters are working properly and billing usage is accurate. That doesn't mean that people don't have a lot of detailed questions and that people aren't frustrated and that we haven't made mistakes.
Hartnett made her remarks while discussing a proposal CMPs made to the Public Utilities Commission. It includes a $6 million compensation fund for any residential consumers that regulators find have been overbilled. The utility is also planning to fund a pilot project in which Efficiency Maine will do energy audits for some residential customers with persistently high electric bills. A report out today from the UN looking at climate change and land use has some implications for New England. WBUR's Miriam Wasser explains.
In New England, forests and coastal wetlands provide defense against climate change by sucking carbon out of the air. Today's report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says we need to do a better job protecting these ecosystems. It also says we need to use more climate-friendly farming techniques, waste less food, and eat less meat. Richard Houghton is a scientist at the Woods Hole Research Center and a co-author of the report. He's optimistic.
The way we humans have been using land has contributed to the climate change problem. But we know enough that we could change our ways and actually use land to be part of the solution.
Today's publication is the second of three special reports from the panel. From the New England News Collaborative, I'm Miriam Wasser.
And a ferry service that takes residents and visitors to islands in southern Maine will get more than $3.4 million in upgrades from the federal government. Casco Bay Line's Portland Terminal is currently operating well over capacity. In weather tonight, mostly cloudy with some scattered showers, lows in the low to mid-60s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the low 70s to low 80s, partly cloudy at night, lows in the 50s. Last year, Maine's harvest of softshell clams was one of the worst in many decades, down to around 7 million pounds. That's due in part to closures of polluted flats and predation by the invasive green crab. But harvesters and other observers say the fishery can bounce back, and new efforts to better protect the resource are emerging in more than a dozen coastal towns. Fred Bauer has more.
The Medomic River is Maine's most prolific softshell clam fishery, and Glenn Melvin has been picking them from the mudflats here, off and on, for more than four decades.
All right, so let's go down here, Wade.
Steering a beat-up aluminum outboard downstream from Waldoboro, Melvin sports a multicolored bandana and mirrored sunglasses. The boat flies past cove after cove, which in recent years have been frequently shut down to clamming because of pollution by fecal coliform.
Everything you see, closed. Roughly here.
Melvin points to a line he says marks the area upstream where clam flats once were either closed year-round or closed for a week or more every time there was runoff from a significant rainstorm. He says he feared a time when the flats would be closed more than half the season. So in 2014, he teamed up with fellow harvesters, state and local officials, scientists, and conservationists to answer a basic question.
Why is this polluted? What in this town is causing so much pollution that it's getting worse every year and could close the river?
To find the answer, the group tried a lot of different methods. They tested the water for E. coli bacteria hotspots, then clambered upstream to try to find the source. They put smoke bombs in the town's sewers to look for leaks. They hired bacteria-sniffing dogs and deployed a new DNA test that could identify whether the E. coli came from humans, dogs, or birds. A big break came one day when Melvin was walking around a town boat ramp.
I noticed this dog crap all over the landing. And some of it you could kick in the river. It was 2 feet from the river. And I thought to myself, a good rainstorm washes this right into the river. We got together and built this project, and we're shoving dog crap down the river.
Melvin and some of the town's 150 remaining harvesters led a successful referendum to ban dog walking in such areas. And over the next several years, the Madamik Group identified multiple pollution sources and encouraged property owners to fix them, from residential sewage pipes to a big seaweed processing plant. Incrementally, the river got cleaner, and the state lifted restrictions on more areas. By this year, more than 360 acres of flats, maybe a third of the traditional growing area, has been reopened with no conditions.
And I think there's a model there for collectively confronting the many kinds of challenges that we're currently facing.
Bridie McGreevy is a fellow at the George G. Mitchell Center for Sustainability Solutions, and she's a leader in a multi-town, multi-stakeholder shellfish resilience project that's awarded grants to 14 coastal municipalities. The initiative, financed by the Broadreach Fund, aims to better document and protect clam and mussel populations in Maine and do much the same for the harvester community, which has dropped from around 6,000 two decades ago to just 1,500 now.
Things are dire. There's no denying that.
McGreevy says the Gulf of Maine's warming waters have benefited the population of green crabs, which are a voracious predator of baby clams. Researchers say predation is the chief culprit in the severe drop-off in the clam harvest, from more than 37 million pounds in 1977 to less than 7 million in 2017.
Many of the issues that we're currently facing and the multiple signs of decline in the clam fishery are linked to climate change. They're linked to other pressures as well, and poverty is one of those. Lack of capacity in coastal towns is another.
Other pressures on the clam harvesters include injury from years of physical labor and opioid abuse related to those injuries. There are conflicts over licenses as municipalities limit their numbers, disputes over management practices, and always unpredictable market prices to contend with. Researchers, meanwhile, struggle to identify pollution sources and improve the data on the actual health of the clam stocks. In the Damariscotta River, just down the coast from the Madamik, Jess Woodall and Cassandra Strauch are counting clams in a carefully marked off area of muck.
Just so we know the boundaries of where we're digging inside the plot.
It's basically a defined volume.
Over the summer, these interns at the University of Maine's Darling Marine Center, joined by scientists and local harvesters, laid 700 grid plots along the river's banks to count clams and quahogs and build a baseline population database. Because the historical data on clam populations are weak, the researchers are also interviewing dozens of local clammers to dredge up their deep knowledge of the resource, as well as the industry's local ebb and flow.
They've all noticed a lot of different things. So right now we're still like gathering the data and analyzing it. But the biggest trend that we've seen, a lot of them have noticed that the clams have been declining.
Get another one?
Yeah.
More than a dozen other shellfish projects are underway this year, from Yarmouth to Beals Island. In Georgetown, a group of harvesters is focusing on quahogs, which may be more resistant to warming water temperatures. In Harpswell and other towns, tests are underway to see whether tree boughs placed in clam beds measurably help juveniles flourish, or whether it might be better to focus on protecting clams from predators with netting or other barriers. Project leader Bridie McGreevy.
I have a lot of hope in looking at what people are doing here and the rate at which they're figuring out these tailored solutions to really complex issues.
Back in the Madamik River, clam picker Glenn Melvin says his group's achievements show that the resource may not be as imperiled as many believe.
The Madamik right now is the cleanest it's been in 25 years, ever since they started labeling it and testing it and giving it a value. So we do have a little work to go, but we are so thrilled with the success.
Next up, Melvin and other volunteers are taking data from a recent effort to closely chart currents in the river and using that to scope out the best spots for new clam beds. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, you can visit mainepublic.org and join us tomorrow on Maine Calling at 1 o'clock, where we'll talk about chamber music this summer in Maine. I'm Nora Flaherty.